suddenly light at the end of a long, brutal tunnel.
Well, it's great to be out. It really is. We spent 48 hours all but with no food, little water, surrounded by explosions, gunshots, people running up and down the corridor screaming. It was grim, very grim.
After some grim hours, the Associated Press is reporting that the siege in Mumbai is over. The Jewish center is apparently liberated. Commandos have emerged from the Jewish center in Mumbai with assault rifles raised. Police say the siege is over. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. News just breaking right here at the top of the hour. It's Friday, November 28th. Adora Udoji is away. We'll get right to the top headlines. The hottest fighting in Mumbai is at a Jewish center, and the Associated Press is reporting that commandos have emerged from that Chabad Lubavitcher Center based in Brooklyn, but they have an office in Mumbai, and that the siege of Mumbai is over. There's also a situation at the Taj Mahal Hotel. Hundreds of hostages have escaped so far. Indian security believes about 100 are still inside, along with a few gunmen. But again, it's a very fluid situation. A little while ago, Indian forces secured the Hotel Oberoi, which had been the scene of hours of tough fighting. 10 sites were hit at all. Here's a survivor of the grisly scene at the Leipold restaurant.
There was blood everywhere. I was drenched in blood. But, I mean, I came out of it. All I had was like a little bump on my head. When I got down to the floor, and when the guy who pushed me to the floor said to me, "Stay down, keep quiet," then that's when I realised that that there must be some kind of a terrorist attack.
The question now, of course, is what's next? And Femi Oke is here with a look at more from Mumbai and the other stories around the world.
Thanks, John. More than 140 people are dead and hundreds more injured, including at least 8 foreigners. There are no known American deaths. Those numbers are bound to rise as medics get access to the sites of the attacks. It's unclear who launched the attack. We know that a previously unknown group claims responsibility and that attackers had a particular interest in fighting American, British and Israeli hostages. Indian officials have raised the possibility of a Pakistani connection, but Pakistan condemned the attacks and denied helping them. In Thailand, anti-government protesters are consolidating control of 2 Bangkok airports, stopping flights and stranding travellers, including many Americans. Demonstrators say that they're preparing for a violent crackdown, but it appears the government does not yet intend to use force to dislodge them. Just getting news in this hour in the last few minutes as well that the head of police for the Thai government has resigned. The markets reopened in India today. The key index there closed up following the positive trend across most of Asia. Our Wall Street will be open for a partial day of trading today. John.
And of course, it's a Black Friday, as you mentioned. The holiday shopping season begins. Think of us as Santa there at Macy's, all right? You're sitting on our lap. What do you want this holiday season? Tell us what you want. What's going to get you out to the stores? Is it a giant discount? Is it the offer of a refi from your bank? Take 877-8-MY-TAKE and call us or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can talk to us about it, all right? We're listening.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I've lived in Bombay my entire life. This is my home. This is my life. And buildings like, you know, the Oberoi and the Taj Mahal Hotel, we've seen them since we were little kids growing up. This is like the heart of Bombay City. This is what Bombay is to us. And to see, you know, such reckless, disgusting incidents occurring is just heartbreaking.
One of 20 million people asking themselves what now in that city of Mumbai, India, where it appears a consensus is emerging among reports that we are seeing and security personnel are beginning to talk that were in the end game here in Mumbai. The siege that was taking place at the Chabad Lubavitcher office in Mumbai, the Jewish center in Mumbai, appears to be over. That's according to at least two sources. The question really now is, as the final sort of explosions and fires are put out in Mumbai, what is next? Joining us now is Sudhanand Dume, who is the Asia Society Fellow in Washington and author of My Friend the Fanatic. It's a book about Islamic militants. He's speaking to us from Delhi. Sudhanand, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be back.
And also Nazis Avros, who's the BBC South Asia editor, is joining us yesterday. And Nazis, you were really great in keeping us honest and away from the rumor and on top of things, speaking to us from London. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks.
It does appear that some consensus is emerging that this is closer to the end than the beginning. It seems to me that the question now is, what does this mean for relations between India and Pakistan? Already some efforts have been taken on part of both governments to try to diffuse or clarify the situation. Nazis Afroz, what do you make of the situation right now?
Well, it's undoubtedly that there will be some pressure on Pakistan, particularly with the Indian foreign minister today naming Pakistan. When the Indian prime minister yesterday said that some elements from a foreign country, he did not mention Pakistan, but today I think the Indian foreign minister, by naming Pakistan, has actually raised the ante. But at the same time, the Pakistani leadership, they are trying their best to allay the fear that Pakistan government, as a government level, they sanctioned any such thing. In the past, India also, of course, if we go back for a few years, and we will see that in the past, India used to say it was state-sponsored terrorism in Kashmir. Also, some attacks in Delhi, India said very categorically that it was the Pakistan government that authorized those attacks. But here, there is a subtle difference. There is a nuance that they're not saying that it was the Pakistan as a state, as a government, authorized it. They're saying some elements from Pakistan may have been involved or are involved. So there is that difference. And at the same time, we know for certain that since the election in Pakistan in February, there is a marked change in Pakistan, especially with the civilian leadership taking over. They are trying to dismantle and they are trying to revamp their the secret service, ISI. The political wing of the ISI is being disbanded. So all that they are trying to play up. At the same time, they have offered the Pakistan ISI chief even to come to India to share and to talk to the Indian authorities. So it is going to put some pressure, undoubtedly, but at the same time, both sides, I think, they have progressed quite a bit in the last few years, especially there has been people-to-people contact, the track to diplomacy or the back-channel diplomacies, they're paying huge dividend for both the countries. So I don't think they will go to an extent where it's going to ruin the relations between these two countries.
Well, those relations are definitely going to be tested. Sudhanand Dume in New Delhi, what is the sense there in the capital of these overtures, insofar as we understand them at this point, from Pakistan to try to defuse the situation?
You know, the way this is going to play out is going to play out quite differently at two different levels. At the level of the policymakers and people who have been involved with the peace process between India and Pakistan, there has been a concerted effort to, if you will, bulletproof it and make it impervious to these kinds of attacks by what may very well be militants acting on their own volition. But the difference really is that because of the scale of the attack and because of the audacity of the attack, the way this plays out with the public is going to be profoundly different from previous attacks. And also because this comes on the heels of many other attacks across India. So the question is that, you know, wearing a policy hat, the Indians may well want to minimize the impact on the relationship. But wearing your political hat, I can't see how that's possible.
Well, an election campaign is underway or is about to get underway there in India. I'm wondering if the temptation is to go the militant route or the sort of hardline route in the rhetoric, and that the government will be drawn towards that, or if there is a sense that maybe conciliation can be the theme of this election going forward. Sudhanand?
Well, you see, it's at this moment, you know, given the enormity of this attack, it's hard to sell that to the public. it's not hard to sell that to an intellectual class. It's not hard to sell that to people who recognize some of the subtleties of what is going on in Pakistan right now. But I think that in any country on the planet, frankly, just imagine for a moment that this were happening in New York. Imagine for a moment that terrorists had taken over the Waldorf Astoria. And imagine that they'd sort of people had been shot in Times Square. And it turns out that the terrorists, you know, are from, say, you know, Iran. And it turns out that it's very hard under these circumstances for a democratic leadership in any country in the world, not just in India, to argue that restraint ought to be the flavor of the moment.
Although Sudan, although it's an interesting point that you raise. I mean, it raises the question of why was this targeted at what appears to be the most affluent intellectual sort of center of India. Nazis Afros, is it possible that, you know, if this attack had taken place in Madras or in Calcutta or even in Delhi, that it would be a much different sort of populist kind of reaction? What do you make of what Sudanand is saying?
Of course, I mean, any attack on Mumbai, which is the financial hub of India, all these big hotels, the five-star hotels, Taj Mahal Hotel, which is frequented by the top echelons of business community in Mumbai. So definitely the attacks, the plan to attack Mumbai and these places, it was done with a desire to make the biggest impact. There is no doubt about it.
You raised something, Nazis, that I want to get both of your reaction to and maybe clarify. Do you think it's conceivable that this group is acting as a result of the civilian leadership in Pakistan attempting to take control of the ISI and the security forces? And this is a rogue operation that may be the result of political reform going on in Pakistan, a kind of a desperate Hail Mary play to set things back in Islamabad?
Well, I really wouldn't like to speculate on that.
Yeah, you never do. You never.
Yeah,
do.
We wouldn't like to speculate, and we should not speculate
right.
on that. And also, one thing I must say that we still do not have the facts. The operations are still going on. Yes, we know the police are claiming that 8 or 9 people have been taken into custody. It has never happened before with all the previous attacks in India recently in last 2-3 years. We really, I mean, police did arrest some people after things have happened. But also there had been huge skepticism about the authenticities of what the police said even. So for the time being, let's give the benefit of doubt to the police that, okay, they have arrested the right people. And if they can come up with solid body of evidence. So this is what we know, that these people, they came
right.
from Pakistan or from country, then people will believe. But at the same time, I think that the greater danger right now is also we know it in India, it has happened before, that there is this fault line between the Hindus and the Muslims, whether that fault line is going to really widen or not. And there's a big
right.
concern there as well.
That's
so
the
it's
question.
Not only about that, also there had been doubts about whether all these attacks that have happened in the last 2 or 3 years, whether they were done with a particular motive to widen this fault line and to create a huge sort of violence, a cycle of violence.
Well, it's a
that
good point.
India
let me get
yeah.
the last word from Sudanand yeah. Dume in Delhi. Are these people in custody likely to become show trials that will exacerbate religious tensions inside of India, Sudanand? We just have a few seconds.
Well, you know, if they're Pakistani, I think the great care will be taken to distinguish between terrorists coming from outside the country and Indian nationals of whatever faith. So that really depends on whether they're Pakistanis or Indian Muslims. If they turn out to be Pakistanis, as appears likely, I think India has enough finesse to sort of not turn this into a Hindu-Muslim issue.
Well,
if, on the other hand, they turn out to be Indian Muslims, it would be a different matter.
Well, definitely something to watch. Sudanand Dume, Asia Society Fellow in Washington, speaking to us from Delhi, and Nazis Afros, BBC South Asia editor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
After this that has happened in Bombay, that little tourist that did come to Bombay, the expats that are in Bombay, they will always have a fear to come to a place which is so open, which is so lively, which is so welcoming.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We continue now with the security situation in South Asia and begin here in this segment with a theme that was teed up early in the presidential campaign.
It's time for us to withdraw some of our combat troops out of Iraq, deploy them here in Afghanistan, and I think we have to seize that opportunity. Now's the time for us to do it.
Well, the Obama transition team working over this holiday weekend is undoubtedly focused on this transition from Iraq to Afghanistan, whether it actually in reality is as easy to accomplish as the rhetoric made it seem all during the campaign. That transition is the focus of an essay by Noah Feldman in this weekend's New York Times Magazine. He's a contributing writer for the magazine as well as a law professor at Harvard University. Noah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You say that to compare Iraq and Afghanistan is both useful and perilous. Explain.
The upside is that the strategy that we've followed in Iraq recently of upping the number of troops and trying to convince Iraqis to give up on the radicals is one that has worked better than anything else. It hasn't been a success yet, but it's worked better than anything else. And it's natural to think that maybe we should try that in Afghanistan, which is what the generals and President-elect Obama are saying.
And that's the so-called surge, where we increased troops but also worked much more closely with the tribal and religious constituents on the ground in the country.
Exactly. It depends on the idea that you can convince the local people, and especially the tribes, that they have more to gain by joining in with the government and the United States than they do by being insurgents. Now, the danger of applying this in Afghanistan is simply that circumstances are very different and the tribes are very different in Afghanistan than they are in Iraq. They're all called tribes, but in fact, they're of different sizes and different types. And the tribes in Iraq, for the most part, were primed to work with the government because that's what those tribes have always done. And by contrast, the tribes in Afghanistan have typically looked outside of their government and outside of their country to foreign assistance and played off their interests against each other. So there's a risk that if you go to the tribes and rely on them in Afghanistan the way we have in Iraq, it'll lead to more chaos in the country and not less.
So it's fair to say that in Iraq it's more bipolar or tripolar, whereas in Afghanistan you throw al-Qaeda in there, you throw the NATO forces in there, and you've got a multi-level of variables that's much more difficult to manage.
I think that's exactly right, because the Afghan tribes simply have played a bigger role in the history of their country than the Iraqi tribes have in theirs. The Iraqi tribes basically had two choices, as you say. They either sided with foreign forces like al-Qaeda or they sided with the government. And they switched from siding with al-Qaeda to siding with the government, and that was a huge plus for the government and therefore in the U.S. In Afghanistan, it's not so simple. The Taliban, for example, are not foreign fighters. They are Pashtuns, mostly, from inside of Afghanistan. And so walking away from them is nowhere near as easy for tribal leaders as it was for tribal leaders in Iraq. That means that these tribes will have a whole range of interests and the danger of civil war, which is, of course, how we got the Taliban in the first place in Afghanistan, that nobody else was powerful enough to take over, is a very live one.
Now, that's an argument, forgive me, for describing Afghanistan as something of a black hole that would require almost unbounded troop efforts and military vigilance on the part of the United States to even begin to control, in a sense, what was always said would come true in Iraq might actually come true in Afghanistan, if what you're saying is the case.
I think that's a real risk. Historically, what Afghanistan has had that worked the best, not that worked perfectly, but the best, was a central government that didn't try to govern the local provinces in a direct way, but relied on intermediaries. And that's what the government's optimal solution is here in Iraq, to find intermediaries who are not the Taliban, or if they are the Taliban, are a much more moderated Taliban that recognize rights for women and don't harbor terrorism. And then the central government will have to essentially accept that that's the best it's going to do.
Well, then, at the risk of being a real policy wonk here, let's focus on the first scenario. Is there a sustainable kind of power-sharing agreement among these tribes and among these various regions that can actually maintain itself, that won't devolve into some kind of Taliban today, another Pashtun group tomorrow, maybe it's the Northern Alliance next month?
It's possible, but it's not easy to achieve. It depends on giving all the different groups a substantial stake in governance in their own regions, which they dominate, while making sure that none of them think that they can take over the country the way the Taliban once did or the way that the Northern Alliance did with our help. I think they all will recognize in the foreseeable future that they'll recognize that we're serious enough about staying to stop them from taking over the country. Then they'll say, well, we should settle for something less. They'll settle for something like, as you say, Pashtun control in the southeastern part of the country, Tajik or Northern Alliance control in the northern part of the country. And it could be called warlordism. I mean, someone will be able to say you've just put into place the warlords. But at least it has the chance of being a somewhat stable arrangement that could last in the long term.
Well, let's take a massively contrary view then. It's possible that what you're saying is also an argument to simply walk away from Afghanistan. I mean, it's not likely that 9/11 is going to be repeated. And if it is repeated, it wouldn't be from Afghanistan. It would be from somewhere else. What's to say that we couldn't just wash our hands of the Afghan situation, especially if it's as complicated as you suggest?
That's a reasonable argument. But I think it's too soon to say that we need to walk away like that for two reasons. One, at this point, walking away from Afghanistan is literally a victory for the Taliban, which means a victory for al-Qaeda. If we walked away, I think it's very likely, and I think most experts would agree, that the Taliban will take control of the country again and do it in relatively short dispatch. They then have every incentive to invite back al-Qaeda.
On the other side, the risk is pretty high. Basically, Barack Obama has to show progress in 3 years, or else his policy comes completely unraveled. Is it possible?
I think that's right. He just got to show substantial improvement before it's time for him to run for re-election. So he should take the risk now of trying to move in the direction of finding a balanced strategy that could work for everybody in the country. Because if he doesn't, if we just get more of the same old, then he'll be under a lot of pressure to withdraw completely 3 years from now.
A suggestion from Noah Feldman, who has an essay in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. He's a contributing writer for the magazine, as well as a law professor at Harvard University and an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Professor Feldman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much, John. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Now, the fight appears to be over at the Hubbard-Lubavitch Jewish Center in Mumbai. That follows a fierce gun battle with heavy fire and a massive explosion. Americans were believed to be among those held captive inside. No word on the hostages yet. The situation at the Hotel Oberoi is under control. Gunmen and an unknown number of hostages are still in the Taj Mahal Hotel in Mumbai. Earlier today, the commando of the unit, trying to flush out the terrorists, told reporters about a backpack his men had discovered at the Taj.
Dry fruits for survival, large amount of ammunition, explosives, money, foreign money. They had seven magazines, filled magazines, fully filled.
Now, this was a highly unusual press conference. The commander was disguised in a black scarf and sunglasses and flanked by his men, who were also heavily armed and dressed in black. There's still a standoff in the Taj Mahal Hotel, where gunfire has increased recently. Pakistan is asking that India not blame them for the attack. India has frequently blamed the country for other terrorist attacks. India's prime minister hasn't mentioned Pakistan specifically, but he did say that it's clear the attacks are the work of a group based outside of the country. That's a look at the latest from Mumbai for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Staying in Asia now, you might call the track of this particular crisis from the sublime to the ridiculous to the dangerously uncertain. But thousands, if not more, airline travelers are still caught in a standoff between protesters and the government of Thailand and the Prime Minister Somchai Wongsawat. And even though the two airports in Thailand are under a state of emergency and the protests that have shut down the airports emerged just in the last few days, the crisis in Thailand has been growing for months and began with a comical appearance by Somchai Wongsawat, the prime minister, on this cooking show.
Salt later.
No, put, salt butter or not?
This one?
Nah.
This was sweet butter.
Sweet butter.
Sweet butter.
Okay.
We have to continue the rally. We want democracy. We want the prime minister resign from his post. That's it.
I cannot let this protest cause any more unrest and misunderstanding. That is why I declared the state of emergency.
So from cooking show to all-out political crisis, there's the chanting and protesting at the airports in Thailand. It's been brewing for months. But I want to put this latest airport crisis in context, and to help us is BBC correspondent Jonathan Head. He joined us to do just that from Bangkok. Good morning, Jonathan.
Yeah, hi, John. I'm down at the airport now, actually, as we speak. It's pretty rowdy here, but still quite a festive atmosphere.
Now, it's festive in the sense that the government has declared a state of emergency and wants to remove the protesters, but so far hasn't made any sort of military effort to try to do it. Is there a sense of any sort of political demands from the protesters that would end this crisis early?
Well, they're demands that the prime minister simply couldn't accept. I mean, they want the prime minister to resign, but their demands go deeper than that, John. I mean, these protesters do not like any government associated with the former prime minister. We've got to go back a little way. Thaksin Shinawat, a very powerful man who's in exile now. But the current government is led by his party. It's a party that's very good at winning elections. It's got a lot of support up in the countryside. And the protesters here cannot stomach the idea of any party associated with him being in government. So what they're actually suggesting is that democracy should really be torn up and that Thailand should have a sort of semi-democracy with half of the members of parliament appointed. The government, of course, says we were legitimately elected less than a year ago. We won't accept that. The government's problem is it's a fairly weak government anyway, but it also does not have the support of the army. And the police have so far not been anything like strong enough to come in and retake this airport that is absolutely, it was vital to Thailand's economy.
Well, Jonathan, over the last several months, I've talked with colleagues and friends who live in Bangkok who say that life has gone on normally, even though this protest has continued. Yet, as you point out, this airport is the lifeblood, the artery of the Thai economy. This is a major escalation, and life can't go on as normal now, right?
I think we'll see a steady erosion. I think it's one of those crises where the full impact will only be felt later. But we are seeing, in effect, a complete collapse of any kind of normal law in Thailand. I mean, the protesters have carried out the most extraordinary, breathtaking actions, and the police have been powerless to stop them because they're not liked, they're demoralized, and because the country is deeply polarized. And, you know, this has been a long political crisis. It's been germinating over probably 3 years, where there's been no resolution between people who still passionately support former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat and his party who are now in government, and those who passionately oppose him. I should say those who oppose him, the ones who are holding this airport, it's hard to measure their support. There's not that many people here. Now, perhaps as I look out now, about maybe 3,000, but their tactics have been incredibly sophisticated. They've got military backing, and crucially, they have the backing of some very powerful figures close to Thailand's influential monarchy, and that's given them enormous confidence. They're very well funded too. I mean, some of the government supporters are describing this takeover of the airport as nothing really different than a real coup. And that's what's so dangerous, because if in this vacuum which we have now, the military do step in, and that's quite probable now, the supporters of the government are likely to come out en masse and oppose that. It will be a lot worse than the last coup.
Jonathan, before we go, I want to ask you two questions. One, what are the regional implications of this? I mean, is China going to tolerate this sort of instability on its border indefinitely? Or maybe they're actually happy about it because China competes with Thailand on certain commercial levels.
No, I think China prizes stability above all things in the region and will be deeply dismayed, as indeed all of Thailand's allies. Remember, Thailand is one of the closest and oldest allies of the United States. And I can tell you, the diplomats are tearing their hair out. They're beside themselves. They see a country that has been seen as a bastion for stability and for economic progress in this region for decades literally falling apart, and they don't know how to stop it. They're urging the government to regain control of these airports because Thailand is effectively cut off. And remember, they've got lots of their own citizens trapped here, unable to get out. At the same time, they recognize any operation to retake this airport, if it's bungled, which it might well be, might well spark off a military coup and much worse chaos.
Jonathan, very quickly, any chance that the stranded passengers will get home anytime soon?
Look, they've been getting flights, some flights, into the military airbase, the one left over from the Vietnam War at Utapao. That's about 2.5 hours south of Bangkok, but not nearly enough. I think passengers can get out, but it's not easy. They've got to drive to other airports or even take cars or trains to neighboring countries. So they're really determined they could get out, but it's difficult and it will take them a long time.
Well, Jonathan, thanks so much for the update. Jonathan Head is the BBC correspondent at one of the airports under the state of emergency and closed in Bangkok, Thailand. And now headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much, John. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Now, we have some conflicting reports on the situation at the Hubert Lubavitch Jewish Center in Mumbai. The initial information said that Indian police had taken control, but our partner, the BBC, is reporting that a National Security Guards commander says his forces still have one more floor to go. Hostages are still inside the Taj Mahal Hotel. There's been a recent increase of gunfire and explosions there. More than 140 people are dead. More than 300 people are also injured over the whole couple of days of the attacks and after a series of attacks around the South Indian city of Mumbai. Now, 10 locations were actually attacked on Wednesday night, including a business and residential complex called Nariman House. Police surrounded the complex today. The Director General of the National Security Guard said that 5 hostages are now dead at Nariman House. Terrorists are still on the third floor. And he also said this to the Times Now TV in India. Stocks in Asia are mostly up, including in India. Trading is back up in markets there after suspension yesterday. American markets were closed for Thanksgiving. Today, traders will be back at work, but only for a partial day of trading. An Airbus A320 has crashed off the coast of France. At least 2 people were killed when the jet crashed into the Mediterranean yesterday. It was a maintenance flight, so there were only 5 other passengers on board, and they are currently missing. French and German investigators are heading to the crash site today to find out why it went down. And that's a look at some of the main stories making news. Obviously, still a confusing situation in Mumbai, but we're trying to get you the latest and make it as clear as possible.
But it seems the end is near.
Very near, yes. And the police are taking control with the commando units.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Adore Udoji is away. Among the people here in the United States riveted to television images of what's going on in Mumbai are members of the Indian American community. And joining us now is Amy Paul, who's Indian American Development Director at the Northern Manhattan Coalition for Immigrant Rights. She's here in the studio with us. And you grew up in Florida but have family in Mumbai.
Absolutely.
You know, what's going on in communities all around, certainly in the New York area, there's lots and lots of South Asians who live here and talk very, you know, openly and, you know, about events taking place in the world. What's happening?
Sure. The Indian community here in New York is very tightly knit. So because of that, immediately after the news broke on Wednesday, people started texting each other, calling each other, emailing each other, both within this diaspora community as well as back home. Unfortunately, back home, a lot of the phone lines had been cut, so it was very difficult to reach families within Bombay itself. But within a day or so, most people that I know personally did report to be safe and sound.
And this is one of the highest texting communities probably
sure,
absolutely, in the
world. Absolutely. I mean, it was almost immediate that once the news broke that there was this kind of viral impact.
No, and you've got communities in Chicago and on the West Coast, mm-hmm. and I know people were in touch with each other, you know, throughout this. Has it served to spread rumors and kind of make the conversation maybe a little more tinged with an edge because it's difficult to know what's exactly going on?
I mean, I think that one thing that I did notice is people were paying attention to regional news, so news that was in their kind of regional language, broadcast from India, as well as what was happening here. So people were trying to get information from as many sources as possible to see if they could get, you know, on-the-ground reports as well as the New York Times or, you know, whatever their local newspaper was. So,
I mean, this is actually an ideal time to be able to use the media to get a variety of information. I mean, the U.S. is covering, you know, this area actually pretty well this weekend, sure. But there's also South Asian, Indian sources of information available on most cable systems.
Sure. And also there's the Saja Listserv, which is a South Asian Journalists Association that is, you know, very well-researched, very well-developed, both in New York as well as in the greater U.S. area. So they were having, I think, every 12 hours webcast with prominent South Asian authors, researchers, people on the ground there. The network is incredibly well laid out.
As tragic as it is, it's a sort of a restatement and an endorsement of the sense of diversity and unity here in the United States. I've noticed and seen a lot of coverage of memorial services around the New York area and
Absolutely.
Around the country. What's been going on there?
Sure. I mean, I don't know personally except what I heard on the news about the gathering in the Flushing Temple yesterday.
Right.
But one thing that I do want to make point is that my family is Indian Christian, and this morning when I took a cab to come here, that my driver was Indian Muslim, and you know, the temple was most probably Indian Hindu, and so I think that the alarm about what happened, the panic, as well as the kind of level of sympathy, has definitely crossed all religious and regional barriers. It doesn't matter where you are from in the subcontinent. That level of sympathy and empathy for what's happening and eagerness to know has definitely, you know, crossed all communities.
And that even was conveyed in your taxi on the way over here.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, that must be a powerful message, because the history of South Asia is all about those divisions. Amy
sure.
Paul, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Amy Paul is the Indian American Development Director at the Northern Manhattan Coalition for Immigrant Rights, watching, like so many of us, the situation in Mumbai.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much, John. The time is coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Let me get you up to date with the terrorist attacks that started in Mumbai on Wednesday evening. It looks like the situation at the Hubbard Lubavitch Jewish Center in Mumbai is almost over, although the BBC is reporting that national security guards say that the forces have one more floor to go. Hostages are still inside the Taj Mahal Hotel. And over the 10 locations that were actually attacked on Wednesday, there's a business centre known as Nariman House. The police have surrounded the complex today. And again, National Security Services say that terrorists are still on the third floor and five hostages have been found there dead. Now, Pakistan says that its prime minister has agreed to send the country's intelligence chief to India to help investigations into the Mumbai attacks. The offer follows an assertion by the Indian foreign minister that elements with links to Pakistan were involved in the Mumbai attacks this week. Pakistan has denied any involvement, and its foreign minister, Shah Mehmood Qureshi, is in India today.
I've come to build bridges. I've come to say that we have to develop a better understanding. Let's not jump to conclusions. Let's not go in for knee-jerk reactions.
And as we stay in Asia for another major story, in Thailand, anti-government protesters have control of two Bangkok airports, stopping flights and stranding travellers, including many Americans. The Thai government has said that it's dismissed the national police chief. This news just in the last 60 minutes or so. And this follows its pledge to use police to remove the protesters from the airports. It appears that the government does not yet intend to use force to dislodge the protesters.
The governing party in Zimbabwe and the opposition movement for democratic change have signed an agreement which would allow for the implementation of a power-sharing deal. They have agreed an amendment to the constitution to create the post of prime minister, the position that's been promised to the opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai. So progress on that front. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi. So it's the day after Thanksgiving, and there's plenty of leftovers around the house, right? You've got leftovers on the shelves of all the refrigerators stacked around the counter. Well, forget food leftovers. Let's talk about musical leftovers. Leftovers aren't just about food. The world of music is filled with repurposed pieces and themes that have a life that the composer never intended. And to identify and celebrate them, we've invited Terrence McKnight, as we love to do when we're curious about a musical concept, back to The Takeaway. He's the host of Evening Music on WNYC. Musical leftovers, Terrence McKnight. What are we talking about here?
First thing on the menu, John, is a piece that's about 200 years old.
They last, these leftovers.
That's right. Beethoven wrote one opera. He completed one opera. He wrote it in 1805. But he wrote four overtures, four introductions to this opera. And let's get a sense of what the first one sounded like. So this is 1805. He decided, well, that didn't quite work because what the overture was supposed to do was supposed to get the audience's attention. There were no blinking lights, no PA announcer. So he wanted to grab the attention of the audience and kind of give them a preview of what was going to happen in the opera, the musical sounds. So he took another stab at writing an overture. Here's another one.
I guess he wanted that note to be longer.
It's like leaving the turkey in the oven just a little bit longer.
Yeah, I think so.
So that wasn't good enough. He took another stab, and then finally in 1814, he took the last stab at writing an overture, and he calls this one Fidelio. The opera is called Fidelio. Here's the Fidelio overture. And so by this point, Beethoven's, his hearing was, you know, it was worsening, so.
And a lot had happened in Europe between 1805 and 1814. That's great, that transformation.
So you hear this is a much bigger, broader sound, and maybe that had something to do with the audience, but his own hearing as well.
And the overture is more famous in some ways than the opera.
It is, because composers and conductors, they still use those throwaway overtures, like Bernstein, for example. He would stick the third Leonore overture in somewhere in the second act. And so they are still being recorded, these overtures.
So all four of the overtures get used, just like, you know, it all eventually gets eaten, says
so
Mom
they say.
After Thanksgiving.
That's right.
So what else you got?
Well, we'll go up to 1878 with Tchaikovsky, go over to Russia. And Tchaikovsky in 1877, he had gotten himself into a bad kind of marriage, and he got himself out of the marriage and was a little bit depressed about it, and so he wanted to write a violin concerto, had never done so.
His response to his marriage breaking up is to write a violin concerto.
That's right.
Interesting. Yeah. Different people do different things. So anyway, he decided he'd never done it before.
Never done it before.
So what did he do?
He wanted to write a violin concerto, and so he did. He wrote one, three movements, and the violinist he wrote it for thought it was unplayable, too difficult. And so Tchaikovsky was a little, didn't have a lot of confidence writing for violin. And so he wrote two second movements. And I want you to hear the one that's played now, the one that stuck, the one that when you go to hear Tchaikovsky's violin concerto, you're going to hear three movements. Here's the second part of it. So he calls that a canzonetta. But the first attempt at writing the second movement for this violin concerto, a lot of violinists still like to play it.
Because it's unplayable. I mean, who wouldn't? You want to show off, right?
So he called the first attempt a meditation. And we've got a recording of Joshua Bell playing the meditation. I want you to hear a bit of this. Thank you. So even though it's not included in the concerto, Joshua Bell and other violinists still find it quite beautiful and get a lot of good use out of this leftover.
Well, it's interesting that even though it's called unplayable first time around, both versions live as satisfying musical events.
Yeah, and I think probably the unplayable part had to do with those first and third movements that were a little more virtuosic, and the violin, you know, it's just all over the place. And
you know, we've advanced since the 1870s. Right. You may think you can't play it, but there are some violinists out there who will. You know, when I think of leftovers, I think of it a little bit differently. You know, you made too much of a dish, that casserole that, you know, you got tons and tons of and you don't know what to do with. Something like this musically. Grateful Dead, Dark Star. Depending on what they took before the concert, that song is either 2 minutes long or 2 hours long. There's a leftover. Kind of a different idea.
Yeah. Well, our table was big enough for all kinds of...
What do you got for us to end up?
Well, we've got a piece from 1930. Duke Ellington wrote a review for the Cotton Club in 1930, and he called the piece Swanee River Rhapsody. Here it is.
Perfectly nice song.
Mm-hmm. And it worked. It worked in the review. People at the Cotton Club enjoyed it. But it didn't really have any staying power outside of the Cotton Club. So Ellington stuck it in the fridge. 2 years later, he brought it back out and called it Lazy Rhapsody. Didn't change a note. Same music. Different title.
And it's a hit.
You can buy it on iTunes.
That's great. Moral of the story, just change the name. It's not mashed potatoes 2 days old. It's potato fritters. Terrence McKnight, thanks so much for coming in to talk about musical leftovers here on The Takeaway. Terrence McKnight, of course, is host of WNYC's Evening Music. Happy Thanksgiving, Terrence.
Bon appetit.
Some leftovers can last for centuries if they're musical leftovers. We're always on at The Takeaway, of course. We'll continue to follow the developing story in Mumbai. Remember, 143 dead at this point, more than 300 wounded. If you missed anything of our coverage, take our podcast to go. Subscribe at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. As India looks for more about the culprits and is eyeing Pakistan, what do these attacks mean for the mood and future of Indo-Pak relations? Here's your takeaway.
It's very hard under these circumstances for a democratic leadership in any country in the world, not just in India, to argue that restraint ought to be the flavor of the moment.
That's Sudhanand Dume, Asia Society fellow in Washington and author of My Friend the Fanatic, as your takeaway. It's Black Friday, millions hit the stores, it's cold, you're broke, with all those leftovers in the fridge, what deal would get you out of the house today? What percentage discount does it take? I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Of course, today, while shoppers look for deals, retailers look for economic wisdom.
Never say never when it comes to shopping, because people do the darndest things.
That's retail analyst Todd Marks, who says today's shopping volume may be the best economic indicator of the bunch as the holiday season gets underway. What's the deal, Santa? Should I get the HD TV or a refi? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, November 28th. Adora Udoji is away. We've got plenty to deliver to you as far as Black Friday coverage is concerned. The economic indicators are actually a little more surprising than you might think, but let's get straight to the headlines. Elite Indian commandos appear close to finishing the battle at a Jewish center in Mumbai. There are conflicting reports from the chaotic scene, and it's not clear if fighting is still going on, but there were reports earlier today that police had full control of the building. But now Indian security forces say the operation isn't over yet. The building is at a local office of a New York-based Orthodox group, and American hostages are believed to have been inside. There's also a continuing hostage situation at the Taj Mahal Hotel. Gunfire and explosions have heated up in that Mumbai location. Hundreds of hostages have gotten out. Indian forces believe about a dozen are still inside, along with a handful of gunmen. But earlier today, Indian commandos gained complete control of the Hotel Oberoi. Femi Oke is here with a look at more from Mumbai and other big stories around the world.
Hello there to you, John. Good morning, all. More than 140 people are dead, hundreds more injured, including at least 8 foreigners. There were no known American deaths, but these numbers are bound to rise as medics get access to the sites of the attacks. To give you one example, a business center in Mumbai, 5 hostages have been found dead there just this morning. Now, it's unclear who launched the attack. We know a previously unknown group claims responsibility and that attackers had a particular interest in fighting American, British and Israeli hostages. Indian commandos said that they've attacked appears to be well-trained. The attackers appear to be well-trained. And counter-terrorism analyst Alistair Miller says that tracing the attack is difficult at this early stage.
People are reluctant to make the connection to Al-Qaeda right now, but because of the level of coordination, there could be something there. This does have the hallmarks of an Islamist jihadi attack, so there could be a connection there.
Indian officials have raised the possibility of a Pakistani connection. Pakistan condemned the attacks and denied aiding them. Pakistan's intelligence chief is en route to India to help the investigation. Markets reopened in India today. The key index there closed up following the positive trend towards most of Asia. And Wall Street will be open for a partial day of trading today. And today is the official opening of the holiday shopping season, Black Friday.
So what gets you out to shop? Does it take much?
Oh, I only shop in sales. I'm so cheap.
So today you're going out, right?
Yeah, I need to.
So you're leaving here directly?
In about an hour or so.
You don't need much of an inducement?
No, no.
10% down is fine for you?
No, like 20, 30 is good. Yeah.
Well, how about you? What's your threshold to actually go and face the crowds on Black Friday? What deal would get you out of the house today? 10%, 30, Santa coming and giving you a refi personally, Santa as a banker? Call 877-8 My Take or mytake@thetakeaway.org. What would cause you to jump into Black Friday? Or think of us as Santa. Just say, this is what I need, Santa.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. It's been a day of peaks and valleys in Mumbai as reports of tentative success on the part of security forces fighting terrorists in that city were initially confirmed and then denied. And the entire city of 20 million is riding this roller coaster. We spoke with Rahul Tandon, BBC correspondent in Mumbai, a short time ago about the emotional feelings there.
It's been a very jittery day here. There were reports earlier this morning that there had been gunfire at one of the main railway stations in Mumbai. Those turned out to be false, but I think that gives you an indication of how panicky people are at the moment. The stock exchange offices were then shut down in the main part of the city. I think today many people are just sitting at home watching this unravel on Indian television channels, hearing and seeing the explosions and the gunfire that is taking place at the moment. It is going to take quite a period of time for at least this part of the city to come back to normal.
And that's just one part of the city of Mumbai. What will it take for India itself to come back to normal, the city of Mumbai to come back to normal, or the region of South Asia to respond to this security crisis in a way that doesn't escalate tensions in a very tense part of the world? Joining us to discuss what's next, particularly from the perspective of India and Pakistan, is former permanent representative to the United Nations from Pakistan, Munir Akram, and MJ Gohel, executive director of the Asia Pacific Foundation, a security and intelligence think tank in London. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Munir Akram, Ambassador, if you could first respond to suggestions from the Indian foreign minister that there were elements in Pakistan or external elements that may have been responsible for this attack. I don't want to, you know, put words into his mouth, but it seems that on some level the accusations are beginning as early as this morning.
Well, you know, this is almost a Pavlovian reaction from India. Every time something goes wrong in India, Pakistan is blamed. I remember even when the plague broke out in Gujarat, some Indian officials started blaming Pakistan for that. So I think one has to see the situation on the ground. These are boys or people who declared that they are from the Deccan Mujahideen. It's obviously an indigenous group, and there are so many indigenous problems in India, so many divisions. The Muslims are at the bottom of the socio-economic class. There are huge resentments. There are oppression. There are acts of pogroms that have happened against them. And anger, obviously, is now turning to resistance and some sort of organized resistance. So I think it's a very, very difficult to make a connection straight away with external forces.
MJ Gohil, what's your assessment of what Ambassador Akram is saying and your assessment of how the security authorities in India have handled this so far?
Well, I think it's very early at the moment to come to any kind of conclusions. But I think this idea that there is some group called the Deccan Mujahideen is ridiculous. The fact is that no such group even exists. Before an attack, well-established groups do keep changing their names. A Pakistani group known as Harkat-e-Mujahideen changed its name to Harkat-e-Ansar, then changed it back to Harkat-e-Mujahideen again, then called itself Al-Faran, and so on. The name means absolutely nothing. What matters is the modus operandi, and the modus operandi here is of a Al-Qaeda-linked Islamist group which wanted to perpetrate terror on a mass scale. It was multiple coordinated attacks. These are the fingerprints of a global jihadi group. Now, as far as the Pakistani connection is concerned, unfortunately, there is a long history of this. I mean, one can go back in time to 1989 when cross-border terrorism started in Pakistan and the militants were coming over across the border. It's an established fact. Subsequently, Asif Muhammad Hanif and Omar Khan Sharif, two British Pakistanis, ended up as suicide bombers in May 2003 in Tel Aviv in Israel. Then there was a July the 7th bombings in London in 2005. British Pakistanis were involved in that.
Let's get a response from the ambassador.
Okay. India's got to look at its own problems. You're suppressing the Muslims for 60 years. Pogroms against them. What do you expect them to do? They will respond. They will organize against them. And does not require a Pakistani hand. There are 120 million Muslims in India. And they have the same resentments against the oppression and discrimination they suffer as other Muslims. You don't need, and the hallmarks of modus operandi, what about the Tamil Tigers? They have the same modus operandi.
All right, MJ Gohil and Ambassador Akram, let me tee up what the foreign minister of Pakistan said in comments intended to be condolences to the government of India, that he's trying to build bridges between Pakistan and India. MJ Gohil, do you think this is possible at this point? And what should these two countries be most concerned about in the aftermath?
Well, I think bridges need to be built, and I think they can be built. But the problem is that, on the one hand, there's a democracy in India, and there has been one for the last 60 years. In Pakistan, democracy keeps getting derailed by the military intervening. The last time the Indians put out a hand of friendship was when Vajpayee, the Indian Prime Minister, went on his bus diplomacy to Lahore to talk to the Indian Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. At this very same time, their Chief of Army Staff, General Musharraf, was planning the Kargil invasion of India. And this is what happens: is that the Pakistani military keeps interfering.
Let's get a response from the ambassador.
First of all, I mean, throughout history in India, Pakistan, the provocations, I'm not saying have been one-sided, but definitely there have been provocations from India. They're the ones who attacked East Pakistan, broke us up. They're the ones in 2002 deployed the army and threatened to march against Pakistan.
They have tried to bully us for 60 years. I think that Pakistan, as a state, has responded, has resisted the domination of India. That is absolutely true. But to say that every attack, every act of terrorism in India should be laid at the door of Pakistan, and that the military dictatorship is the only reason that India is different. India's democracy is a hollow democracy. It's a democracy which keeps 90% of the people poor and downtrodden. 17 violent insurgencies are taking place in India today.
All right. Well, both of you are making a very strong case, from my perspective, in tone and in the historical recitation of the sort of violence and counterattacks that have taken place since 1948, that this is a situation that is very much in danger of spiraling out of control, that these events will not be confined to Mumbai. How is that not the case, MJ Gohil?
Well, India has suffered from terrorism, as I said, since 1989. Mumbai itself has suffered attacks six times since 1993.
Right, but how does this not get out of control, spiral out of control, become a major regional escalation?
Well, this is going to be obviously a lot more difficult in the sense that if there are further attacks in other cities, then there obviously will be a reaction. One hopes that there will not be any further attacks. And it's really a question of the intelligence and security services being able to penetrate any potential plot.
Right. But MJ Gohil, isn't it also on the responsibility of the Indian government to maybe preemptively suggest that maybe what we need is a bilateral Indian government, Pakistani government condemnation of terror at the outset, so that at least the governments are above the fray here a little bit?
Well, yes, absolutely. In fact, the Pakistani foreign minister is in India at the moment. There have been secretary-level talks between the two countries, and some progress is being made. Unfortunately, whenever these attacks take place, it tends to derail that dialogue. And what's obviously needed is a certain amount of confidence-building measures between the two countries.
Okay, well, let me get a final response from Ambassador Akram. Munir?
I think that what you need is to acknowledge that there is a socio-economic problem in India which gives rise to the resentments and resistance from the Muslim youth. And until you address those socio-economic and political issues that affect the Muslims, you will continue to blame external hands in the problems of India, and you will not solve them.
There, as you can hear, at a lively debate. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you. We definitely want to have you back to discuss this further in the days ahead. There's going to be many challenges for both India and Pakistan to deal with the security situation. There's an election that's getting underway in India. That was Executive Director of the Asia Pacific Foundation, MJ Gohil. He's a security and intelligence think tank operative in London. And Munir Akram, who's the former permanent representative to the United Nations from Pakistan. This is what they'll be dealing with in Mumbai and India and in Pakistan in the days ahead.
Well, it's great to be out. It really is. We spent 48 hours all but with no food, little water, surrounded by explosions, gunshots, people running up and down the corridor screaming. It was grim, very grim.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Call me Scrooge or whatever, but, you know, I just don't go along with this day after Thanksgiving, Black Friday, you know, biggest shopping day of the year kind of thing. I mean, only this show would get me to leave the house the day after Thanksgiving, in fact. But if you want to talk to Santa about what it is you need today, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. What do you want? Is it a refi? Is it a big screen TV? Is it a 50% discount? Is it world peace? That's what we want to hear. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Joining us now is Stephen Roach, who's chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia. He joins us from New Canaan, Connecticut, to talk a little bit about the economic indicator that we're really seeing in live, real time unfolding before us as shoppers enter stores and give us an indication of the strength of retail sales this holiday season, which all the predictions suggest are going to be way, way down. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John.
As an economic indicator, what does the strength of this day as we get into the holiday season mean for the overall economy?
This is the day, John, Black Friday, that usually kicks off a burst of euphoric holiday and frenetic holiday shopping. But, you know, the world has been turned inside out. Consumption is falling right now in the final two quarters of this year at a rate Americans have never seen before, and with good reason. We're in a deep recession, and all the rules that have driven the excesses of consumption the past decade, mainly borrowing against a housing bubble, have really been broken down. And so consumers, rather than, you know, go out and buy a flat-screen TV, ought to go out and buy their loved ones a savings bond. We need to save.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. You write in the New York Times that it would be better if people didn't shop so much and did save more. But that seems to be exactly the opposite of what Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson wants people to do by trying to loosen credit by taking money from the Treasury and the Federal Reserve and putting it into relaxed loan liquidity for credit cards and auto purchases, that sort of thing. Do you think they're wrong in what they're trying to do there?
I think this policy is really seriously flawed. We saw U.S. consumption last year hit a world record 72% of America's GDP. No country has ever spent that much.
Wait a minute. Back up a second. What was that again?
72%.
U.S. spending?
U.S. consumer spending. You know, you, me, and our families and everyone else we know collectively hit 72%. The 25-year norm in ending in the year 2000 was 67, which was high enough. But now we've taken it to excess, and we've drawn our savings rates down to zero. We have indebtedness that's over 130% of disposable income. We've pushed this model to excess. Do we want policies to continue to perpetuate a model that has taken us to the brink of economic catastrophe? The answer is no.
Well, let's talk about the implications. I mean, if, as you know, we understand the consumer spending is such a driver of the economy, if people shift to becoming savers, while there may be long-term benefits to having money put away in terms of other aspects of the economy, we're going to have to take a hit for at least a year. What would that hit be if people become savers rather than spenders?
Well, two things. One, you know, the recession continues because consumption is such a huge portion of the economy. But there's absolutely no reason why the Obama administration could not enact measures that would stimulate another portion of America's demand, namely investment in infrastructure, alternative energy technologies, retraining and education programs. There's a lot that we can do that does not necessarily mean giving, putting more money in the wallets of shopping addicted American consumers to rush out and buy.
Now, if Americans were to save, that would allow a pool of money that would make the federal spending on some of those infrastructure programs less expensive. True? And can you explain how that would work?
Look, saving has lots of pieces. Consumers save. In fact, they haven't. Businesses can save. And governments can save, and of course we're in a budget deficit, and they don't. So to the extent that consumers boost their saving, that would mean that the American government might have to run somewhat less of a budget deficit than otherwise might be the case. It's also would be an added advantage, because it would mean that we would become less reliant on foreign saving to keep our economy going, and that has to do with our balance of payments and trade deficits, which would be somewhat smaller as a result. So a savings approach, especially for American consumers, is, I think, urgent, essential, and ultimately win-win.
And it's like that, you know, rhetoric we always hear about OPEC. We should, get off our dependence on foreign oil. That actually is impossible. But we could get off our dependence on foreign debt and foreign lenders by saving more, right? That's what you're saying.
If we save more at home, we'll need to borrow less from overseas savings pools. And that's ultimately a very good thing for the stability of the United States economy, the soundness of the dollar, and a longer-term sustainable growth in the United States.
You know, you're headed into this holiday, Stephen Roach, as an executive at Morgan Stanley. I mean, you know, you're at kind of ground zero of everything that's going on. How are you feeling about this holiday season personally?
Look, this is a watershed period that we're going through. You know, the financial crisis has been ongoing now for about 16 months, John. It obviously took a huge turn for the worst in mid-September, and it's wreaked havoc in our financial markets, in our financial institutions, and we're all trying to make some sense out of where we're headed from here. We need, I think, a sounder financial system, sounder financial institutions, better regulatory and monetary policy, and more prudent behavior on the part of what had become asset and debt-dependent American consumers. If we can pull ourselves together, look inside of ourselves, we'll learn the lessons that we need to learn in a crisis, and that is we need to change things.
Well, good luck to you, Stephen Roach, as the chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia. Thanks so much. And now headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. 29 minutes past the hour. An Israeli diplomat says that there were five bodies found inside the Jewish center in Mumbai. It's not clear what country they're from. The latest reports from our partners at the BBC say that Indian commandos are still working to secure the last floor of the Jewish center, and the terrorist attacks in the south city of Mumbai have left more than 140 people dead after all. Amongst the fatalities include an American and his 13-year-old daughter who were killed in a cafe attack. Former college professor Alan Scher, who's age 58, was part of a 25-strong delegation from the Virginia-based Synchronicity Foundation, which promotes meditation. And in northwest Afghanistan, 30 Afghan troops were killed in an ambush by the Taliban. 16 were captured, 7 Taliban fighters also killed in the battle. John.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, you may have to go shopping because you're a Black Friday, you know, obsessive about the sales today. But you don't want to get any groceries today, do you? No, it's the day after Thanksgiving. I mean, you got leftovers. Your refrigerator is probably filled to overflowing with turkey, excess gravy, and mashed potatoes. So what's a cook to do? I mean, and with a family and with those leftovers, you know, likely to last for days and days and days, you need some advice. Joining us is our friend, New York Times food writer Melissa Clark. She's got plenty of creative hints for us. And Melissa, this is your first Thanksgiving with a baby, right?
Oh, yeah.
About doing things early to make it easy. And now she's got hints for using your Thanksgiving leftovers. First of all, how did it go cooking the meal?
That was a big challenge. Having the baby, you know, strapped to me in the sling and then chopping all the onions and garlic was challenging. But she loved it. She loved the rocking motion. She slept through the whole thing. So
I took your advice. I baked bread early.
Did you?
On
did
this
you?
Schedule. And it worked great.
Did you freeze it?
Froze it and took it out of the freezer and boom, boom, boom.
Oh, that's great. For anyone who missed the last time I was on, there's some great bread recipes on the Takeaway website, right? right?
That's right.
And
you
can make them for Christmas. You don't have to just make them for Thanksgiving.
All right. So I'm noticing this pumpkin pie, which is right next to me. Okay. That's an obvious leftover
from
Thanksgiving.
I've got two
What's
different
your strategy?
Ones. Well, okay. First thing is don't do anything to the pies. Don't put them in the fridge. Just take your – if you even have leftover pie, if you're lucky enough. We were because we baked about 7 pies for 12 people. So, but Man. The thing to do – I mean, it's probably too late to tell you this, but for next year, don't put your pies in the fridge. They're better left out at room temperature because the crust stays crispier. You know how when you put them in the when you put some pastries in the fridge, it gets a little bit condensed. So you don't want to do that. If you've got them in the fridge, take them out right now and let them come to room temperature before you dive into your pie for breakfast, which is my favorite way to use pie for after Thanksgiving.
Pie for breakfast,
which
that is
what
great.
I brought.
Is
what yeah, I brought
that's
for you.
Delicious. Well, I'm going to take a little taste here. What about the non pie
right.
leftovers?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that pie is easy because you take it out of the fridge and you eat it. But I think for a lot of us, we have more turkey than we know what to do with.
Right.
And, you know, how many turkey sandwiches can you eat? I have a limit of 2. And after that, it's like, okay, let me do something else. My favorite thing to do with turkey is to do a pot pie. Have you ever done a pot pie with leftover turkey? It's so easy.
It is easy.
Yeah.
I wouldn't think it was easy because you got to make the crust and all that
no,
stuff.
No, well, you buy the crust. That was what I was going to say. You're tired. You're not going to make crust again.
Exactly.
made crust already for your pies.
Right.
Buy puff pastry. You do, and then just take your turkey, you just chop it up, you put all your leftover vegetables, you put your green beans or your leftover Brussels sprouts or your spinach, whatever you have, into the pan along with your turkey. I like to use a really simple custard of just beating a couple of eggs with a little bit of cream, really, really simple. And then you just cover it with your purchased puff pastry, put it in the oven. You don't even need a bottom crust, just a top crust. And you've got this amazing turkey pot pie. And my favorite way to flavor it, canned chipotle chilies. Because then that takes it out of Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's a great
idea. It gives it a whole other flavor. You take it out of Thanksgiving. You're presenting something new. People feel like they haven't already eaten this, which is great.
Can you freeze these?
Yes, you can freeze them. And then you can also make them on Sunday. You know, the turkey is going to last you a few days. It doesn't go bad for, like, I'd say 4 days. So on Sunday, if there's anything left in your fridge, that's the time to make them, freeze them, and then you can pop them out next weekend.
So forget Tupperware. You can actually just take the leftovers, put them in pie tins
exactly.
with puff pastry, bake them a little bit, freeze some, and the rest become meals.
Right, or do one big pie if that's right. easier. And you probably have your pie tin already pulled out because you've already done your pumpkin pies, right?
That's
so you're
great.
All ready. Another thing, soup. Everybody loves turkey soup. My favorite way to do it is to do a kind of a minestrone turkey soup, which is you use your canned beans and you throw in some pasta and you just boil the whole thing together. And because, again, I think the key is to change the flavor, like doing a minestrone.
I always end up, when I do turkey soup, it becomes this sort of gray,
yes,
misty
exactly.
kind of thing, and I don't like it.
You got to use other flavorings. So think Italian, think Italy, think fresh basil, think tomatoes, think things that you haven't already eaten the night before. Don't put in the cranberry sauce, you know, don't put the sweet potatoes in. You really want to give a new flavor palette to your leftovers so that they taste like something new.
So it's basically turkey from the turkey in a different broth.
Exactly.
You're not making turkey broth out of this.
Well, you could make turkey broth, but then just add herbs, add tomatoes, add canned beans, add pasta, add things that you didn't already eat last night. And that is that's the secret to making leftovers into something that's really exciting.
Okay, help me with the guilt. All right,
okay.
What's not worth saving? What can you dump the next day?
Well, you know, I wrote an article for the Times a couple of weeks ago on dumping mashed potatoes, and people got so mad at me. They said, "No, we love the leftover mashed potatoes." So I used to say dump them. In my article, I said you should make them into something else. I made them into little salmon croquettes, salmon patties. You take fresh salmon or canned salmon,
right,
and you mix it with your mashed potatoes, anything that's left over. And you fry them, and they are the best breakfast
ever.
Anything
you have to put in there to keep them from falling apart, like egg?
Yeah, a little bit of egg.
I
think there's a recipe on the New York Times website for people who want. And I put spinach in them as well, but you can leave that out. You can just egg, mashed potato, and salmon. You can also use, instead of salmon, you could use tuna if you wanted. You could use shrimp. If you are a shrimp cocktail person for Thanksgiving, you can chop up your leftover shrimp. Oh, who has leftover shrimp? That's the kind of thing that gets it. Yeah, never mind about that.
That's a joke. Maybe on Fifth Avenue. Okay, last thought
is cranberry sauce, leftover cranberry sauce. Mix it into your oatmeal today. Mix it into your yogurt. It's the best breakfast ever.
That is a great idea. And it's not oversweet.
Exactly.
And you don't want oversweet stuff after Thanksgiving. Well,
because you have your pie.
That's right. Melissa Clark, New York Times food writer. Thanks so much for coming in. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Melissa Clark, food writer for the New York Times, joined us with all kinds of strategies about dealing with leftovers. And fresh in our newsroom here is Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Hostages are still being held captive at the Taj Mahal Hotel in Mumbai, where gunfire has rung out in recent hours.
Meanwhile, fresh shots have been heard around the Jewish center. That's according to Indian media. The terrorist attacks in the South Indian city have left more than 140 people dead so far. In Pakistan, police say that a suicide bombing has killed seven in the northwest. The attacker drove into a police car. Suicide blasts have increased recently after the US began a series of military strikes in Pakistan near the Afghan border. There's been violence in Thailand because of opposition protests. Now, gunfire caused a Thai newsreader who was working at the opposition TV company to dive for cover during a broadcast. He starts off calmly enough and then have a listen to what happens next. You can hear the gunfire in the background. And then the gunfire actually comes into the television studio. That broadcaster had a few light injuries, but he is doing well. Meanwhile, the political situation is not doing too well in Thailand. It remains very tense. The prime minister will remain in a northern city indefinitely because of tensions with the military. The army chief has called for his resignation. Meanwhile, thousands of anti-government protesters have shut down the main airport in the capital of Bangkok, and the head of police has been fired. Today is Black Friday, traditionally a big day for sales, but in South Carolina, it's not just the stores who are offering the deals, it's the state government. They're offering an unusual perk: no sales tax on handguns, shotguns, or rifles.
Now, what is the motivation for that?
Well, the two-day tax holiday was passed this summer over the objections of Republican Governor Mark Sanford. He's an avid gun supporter, but thinks the tax code shouldn't be used for political purposes.
So get your Uzi. Well, you can't buy Uzi, I guess, but get your handgun, get your 30-06 without any sales tax.
Doesn't include antique handguns, though.
It doesn't include
antiques.
So only if you want to kill someone, you get a tax break.
Of course.
Thank you very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and joining me now is Todd Marks, who writes the Tightwad Todd blog for Consumer Reports. Todd, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you, John?
And there is no chance in hell, I have to say, Todd, that I would ever go shopping on the day after Thanksgiving. But because you sort of track shopping trends in your blog, what is important about this day, which is always referred to as the biggest shopping day of the year, in this sort of dubious economic climate tomorrow?
Well, you know, it is one of the biggest shopping days of the year, and I would always caution people to say never when it comes to shopping, because people do the darndest things. But the reality is that Black Friday is a day where great deals can be had, but it's not the be-all and end-all. I always tell people, you know, we're looking for value this year more so than in the past because of the economy, but we have never seen, and I've been here 20 years covering this sort of thing, and I have never seen in all that time the level of steep discounting that I have this time around.
Well, let's talk categories. Let's talk categories of products. What kinds of things can you get at what kinds of prices that would really make someone like me want to step out of their house?
Well, it's the sales come in one of two shapes. You've got the doorbuster sales that typically get all the publicity, where they'll sell a laptop computer or flat screen TV for, you know, $300 or $400, and each store will get a handful of them, and then people line up by the hundreds, and most of them will walk away empty handed. So you got to hope for the best.
I hate that.
There's also the other kind of sales that you tend to see on Black Friday are percentage discounts off of total purchase. You know, I've seen no shortage of ads that have been saying, take an extra 40% off your entire order, take 20%, take 30%. And those are the kind of things that really encourage people to buy, because it goes after volume. And that's the most typical kind of discounts that people look for on Black Friday.
Are most of the deals that people go for on Black Friday electronic deals, or is it mostly fashion, or is it mostly...
No, it's clothing is the number one gift to give and receive year in and year out, and we do a national survey, a series of them every year at Consumer Reports during the holidays to kind of take the pulse of the American public. The thing that people want most and that they're going to be buying most on Black Friday is overwhelmingly electronic products. 85% of people nationwide surveyed said that they are going to be shopping for all home electronics like flat-screen TVs, MP3 players, and video game systems on Black Friday.
What gives you the sense, and we've seen already retail sales down by records and consumer confidence down by records, what do you see that really says there's a level of desperation out there that consumers can take advantage of?
Well, the fact is that the sales have been fast and furious since the end of September. There has been no let-up in sight in the wheeling and dealing. I sign up for a lot of email alerts at my favorite retailers, and I get dozens of them every day. One day it's buy one, get one free. Next day it's get free shipping. The next day it's take 20% off your order or take $50 off of anywhere. They're just nonstop. So I think it's pretty – unless you're kind of living in a log, it's pretty hard to go completely wrong this year. But you can compound the discounts, and I think they're going to be extended well beyond – the holiday season. I think you'll see it into January easily. So be desperate on Black Friday. The deals are going to be there.
I mean, shouldn't we call it Green Friday or something? Todd Marks, thanks so much. He writes the Tightwad blog for Consumer Reports. You'll find a link to it on our website, thetakeaway.org. And think of us as Santa. What do you want? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello there, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Indian security forces are working to secure the sites that still have to rescue hostages from. Mainly this is the Taj Mahal Hotel in Mumbai. So far, the attacks since Wednesday have left over 140 people dead and many, many hundreds injured. Gunmen and an unknown number of hostages are still in the Taj Mahal Hotel in Mumbai. Early today, the commander of the unit, trying to flush out the terrorists, told reporters that he found a backpack at the hotel and described its contents.
Dry fruits for survival, large amount of ammunition, explosives, money, foreign money. They had seven magazines, filled magazines, fully filled.
What was highly unusual about this press conference was the commander was disguised in a black scarf and sunglasses and flanked by his men, who were all heavily armed and dressed in black. There are also a huge number of members of public around all of the sites that have been holding hostages over the last couple of days. Pakistan says that the Prime Minister Yusuf Razaf Jilani has agreed to send the country's intelligence chief to India to help investigations into the Mumbai attacks. The offer follows an assertion by the Indian Foreign Minister that elements with links to Pakistan were involved. Pakistan denies this. A South Korean train crossed the border into North Korea today for what may be the last time. The North is putting an end to travel on the historic train line. The suspension illustrates the tension that's increased between the two countries since Seoul's new conservative president took office. And food banks received lots of visitors yesterday. One Chicago shelter served 200 Thanksgiving dinners in 40 minutes. And food charities around the country have seen an increased demand in recent months, but a lack of funds. That's a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. And for a moment in Mumbai today, it seemed as though people actually dared to exhale. Those are crowds of people who were cheering Indian commandos outside the Nariman House Jewish Cultural Center, home of the Chabad de Lubavitcher sect in Mumbai, celebrating what looked like at that point the end of the hostage crisis there. But then the sobering news. Indian news reports say 5 hostages have been killed in that headquarters of the Chabad group. 2 Americans also confirmed dead in the Mumbai attacks, not at that particular location. A spokeswoman with the Synchronicity Foundation in Virginia said Friday that Alan Scher and his 13-year-old daughter were killed while they were in a cafe in Mumbai. Joining us now to talk about the details on the ground and also where do we go from here are Keith Bradshaw, who's a New York Times correspondent in India, who has been sending minute-by-minute updates to the New York Times website from his handheld device as he watched what was going on at the Nariman House. Keith, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Also back with us is Shumit Ganguly, who's a professor of political science at Indiana University, on the phone from Bloomington. Shumit, thanks for coming back.
Sure.
Keith, let's begin with you. The city is at this point maybe just beginning to think it's possible to get back to normal, but there's a long distance from here to there at this point. How do things look?
We've had a variety of false alarms. 24 hours ago, there were people claiming that the siege had finally ended at the Taj Hotel, the famous one that's a century old that maharajas and heads of state have long stayed at during their visits to Mumbai. Well, you still had explosives and gunfire from that hotel all day long. Similarly, we had a day full of gunfire and explosions at the Nariman Center, which is the Nariman House, which is the Jewish center in one of the oldest neighborhoods of Mumbai here.
And at that point, it's where the most sobering news came. Can you confirm any of the details that are on the wires and from Indian reports suggesting numbers of hostages, even Israeli reports suggesting terrorists have been found?
No, and you have to be very careful with reports of deaths, particularly in this case of specific individuals. So unless there is absolute confirmation, then it should be treated with caution.
No, understood. And, we've noted that this morning ourselves. Shumit Ganguly, the identity of the attackers and the identity of the victims is going to be very much in the calculus of how India and Pakistan respond diplomatically and in sort of their own domestic politics to this crisis. Where do things stand at this point?
Thus far, the Indian foreign minister has indicated that there was some sort of Pakistani link to this. But beyond that, he has not said much. And Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, in his national address on television, said that some neighbors were involved. When neighbors are invoked tied to terrorist attacks, it's usually a code word for Pakistan. And in addition to that, the highly respected Indian newspaper, which is published from Madras in southern India, The Hindu, reported yesterday that at least one of the people who have been seized by the Indian authorities, one of the terrorists who has been seized by the Indian authorities, is a Pakistani national. So this is if this is indeed true, it is a deeply disturbing fact, and it will cause inevitable repercussions in Indo-Pakistani relations.
Well, the question there, though, is it indeed true? Keith Bradshaw, do you suspect that over the next several days there will be wildly divergent reports of the identities of these terrorists and, even alleged terrorists, because we don't know if we've matched the people who are in detention or the people who have been killed with the actual carrying out of these attacks. Keith?
It's likely that we're going to get wildly divergent attacks, partly because the Indians are playing their cards pretty close to their vests in terms of releasing real details about what they're finding in the investigation.
That's probably a good thing, though, isn't it?
Well, it may be partly a sign of caution. However, it's also a sign of an investigation going slowly. I went to the Leopold Cafe today, which is where gunmen stood at the entrance of what was once a popular tourist place, full of tourists eating their dinners on Wednesday night, and proceeded to machine gun them or to kill many of them using assault rifles standing at the entranceway. When I went to the Leopold Cafe this afternoon, nearly 48 hours later, there were shutters drawn down over the entrances, but there was no sign of any forensic investigation. Now, that may be because there is still a lot of work to be done, but it looked as though all the diners had simply vanished. There was just nobody there. The food was still on the plates, which is quite unsanitary, too, in tropical heat to have 2 days later leaving the food. I don't know if that'll affect the investigation or whether there was just a decision to to close all the doors to the restaurant and leave it there.
Well, certainly the city is in shock. I mean, that's for sure. Shamit, at what point does this event move itself into the political campaign that is underway in some localities and about to get underway nationally in India?
I'm sorry. Would you run that question by me again?
At what point does this event become part of the political rhetoric in some of the campaigns that are getting underway?
Yes, it's already part of the political rhetoric. The BJP has already gone to town with this. They have taken out advertisements in major national newspapers, particularly in New Delhi, because New Delhi is going to the polls today. Another important state in India, Madhya Pradesh, which is a central province of India, is going to the polls today. And I fully expect the BJP to try and tar and feather the Congress-led government with accusations of ineptitude, with accusations of being soft on terror, and that only they can protect the country from a future terrorist attack. I fear that the worst instincts of some people will come to the fore now.
Wow. Keith Bradshaw, final thoughts from you before we go?
Mr. Modi, who is a prominent politician from Gujarat, is here. He has been somebody who has tended to be viewed as aligned with those who want to take a very tough line towards Muslims in India. And so it will be a question of whether this country can retain its multi-religious, multi-ethnic harmony in light of an attack that many are attributing to some kind of Pakistani or Muslim or even Al-Qaeda involvement.
Well, you've stated the challenge very well, Keith Bradshaw, New York Times correspondent in India, joining us from Mumbai, and Shumit Ganguly, professor of political science at Indiana University from Bloomington. Shumit, thanks so much for joining us.
Surely.
And good luck to all of you. We are always on at the Takeaway as we head into the weekend. More voices from Mumbai.
Today, the situation in Mumbai is such that people are actually afraid of their own shadows.
If you want to hear any of our coverage, you can subscribe to our podcast at thetakeaway.org or at iTunes. In America, it's Black Friday as millions hit the stores. So what do you want on your shopping list?
Never say never when it comes to shopping, because people do the darndest things.
That's Tightwad Todd from Consumer Reports taking a look at Black Friday. Who's going to be in the stores? Are you going to be there? I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.